This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Good Things on the Bigger Picture, our weekly segment where we speak to good people doing good things. I'm Lim Soo Ann, and today I'm speaking to the folks behind the Pit Stop Community Cafe, which is a social enterprise working towards solutions for homelessness, urban poverty and hunger in our capital city. Now, they've been operating since 2016, but of course, like many social enterprises and soup kitchens, the past 15 months have not been easy for them. And yet, you know, looking at their, if you follow them on social media, you know, you will see that they have been soldiering on to continue the work that they do to feed and help people from marginalized communities in Kuala Lumpur. So to find out more about what they've been doing and how people can lend a helping hand, I am joined by the co-founders of Pit Stop Community Cafe, Joycelyn Lee and Andrea Tan. How are both of you doing today?
Hi, Sue Ann. Thank you for having us on board. We've had better days, we've had better weeks, and we've had better months. But I think everybody can say the same.
So perhaps for people who don't know, who aren't familiar with the Pit Stop Community Cafe, how would you describe it? And sort of what do you and your team do through the cafe?
So I would say BP, i.e. before pandemic, we had a dine-in concept, and the idea was to provide those who had less, those who were hungry, the homeless, the urban poor, with a place to come in, sit down and have a hot meal, and maybe have a little bit of much-needed human interaction, either with, you know, those who are coming in to eat, or also with our servers, our volunteers. We served hot food. They get to choose their food. And part of the reason why we did that was because we believe that for a person to continue to feel human, they must have an element of choice in their lives. They must also be made to see that they still have dignity, or to remind them that they still have dignity. So, couple of things. I think choice and dignity were very important to us then. Still is. Still very, very, very much important to us. But unfortunately, of course, now, AP, after pandemic, things are a little bit restricted. And so we are now in, what we call survival mode. Survival mode being we make sure that everybody has food, that as many people as possible don't starve. And starvation is a very, very real thing at this point in time.
And I guess to think back to, you know, back in 2016, what sparked both your decisions to start, to set up the Pit Stop, right? What was it that got you to that point?
I had a brilliant flash of stupidity. Andrea had a brilliant flash of insanity. Either together we were Captain Insane and, you know, Miss Stupid. I think for us at that point in time, we looked around and we decided that if we were going to address community issues, social issues, we had to do it in ways that were not explored yet. We looked at the soup kitchens, mostly mobile at that point in time, and what they were doing. We didn't want to duplicate services. There was no point duplicating services, simply because then it's just a matter of reinventing the wheel, and it's you know, I would say it's not proper management of resources. I would also say that, you know, we looked at the possibility of looking at things differently, which was also part of the reason why we chose to go with a Sendirian Berhad as opposed to registering ourselves as a standard non-government organization.
It gave us the flexibility to do whatever we need to do
with fast.
Fast and with the best practices that we learn locally as well as internationally. What can we import from the overseas systems and SOPs? bring it over here? How
customize.
Can we do it?
Customize according to what we need here. I think for us as well, the Sendirian Berhad factor, it was a very simple message. Yeah, we did not want handouts. We wanted our hand up. And that was what we wanted also to give people. If you ask people out there, more often than not, you know, people have pride. They many people do not just want to live on charity, for instance. Yeah, it does something to you to bow your head and to beg for that scrap of bread or whatever it is. And what we wanted was for people to be reminded of what it feels like to stand up straight, lift their heads, and have that human dignity to be able to earn their keep, to be able to support themselves. It's important. That is very, very important. And that was what we wanted to convey as well. And pre-pandemic, we also took on catering jobs. You know, we also took in sponsorships of food. And so that was how we supported ourselves. But we also did catering jobs and everything else so that we could pay for the bills. Yeah. I would call it a hybrid animal that nobody's really seen before, previous to us. Yeah. On top of the dining concept as well at that point in time, the cafe concept. So it was interesting trying to educate people because, you know, people keep saying, I want to do charity.
Or the concept of just doing good.
Or the concept of doing good, yeah. So it was, I think we spent the first few years educating people because so many people had this very conventional, you know, sign the check, philanthropic idea of, of charity.
And very often it's once off.
Yeah, very often once off. And we started out first. You know, we had to go into that system and say, yes, okay, fine, this is charity. But once we got them into our system, it was a matter of, okay, we need to change your outlook slowly. Mm-hmm. And the first step is this. You're not just doing charity because you actually get something out of it. People don't realize that when you, quote-unquote, do charity, you do get something out of it. It's the intangibles. It's the feel-goods, right? It's the adrenaline shot to your system. It's the feel-good chemicals that flood your brain that says, I'm doing good. That is an intangible, but that is also very tangible, the feel-goods. And people pay for the feel-goods, whether it's watching Netflix or eating chocolate. This is pretty much the same thing, right? So for us, it's, okay, you are getting something back. So it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. That's number one, right? So therefore, you are paying for a service. Number two, however, and more importantly is this, you are not merely giving. We look at it as you are investing in your community. Every time you choose to provide something to your neighbor, every time you send in, you know, sardines to a soup kitchen, you are not just giving, you are investing in your community, in making it better. You are investing in children who would otherwise starve. Mm-hmm. You will not see your investment.
Not for some time. But you are investing because, for instance, if the children get better nutrition, if they have access to education and all that, they come back to you as a workforce when they are 18, 21. So you are investing in that person. So for every time that you say you're doing charity, put a face to it. There is someone there who is benefiting from all this.
Every time someone, quote unquote, does charity, what they're actually doing is they're investing in a person. They're investing in someone who, you know, may not have had that chance. They're giving someone a hand up. And that is what we wanted to do, to educate people, because it's always about the hand up. You know, you got to change your mindset from saying this is a hand out to, okay, whose hand am I grasping to pull them out of whatever cycle they're in? And that's that is challenging in and of itself, because I think a lot of Malaysian companies still have a very, very conventional mindset about CSR. And they're still looking at it from the CSR, corporate social responsibility aspect. I personally tell them, drop your social, okay? Because as a corporate entity, you are already a citizen, a corporate citizen. Therefore, it should be corporate responsibility. Of course, now you have all these new terms, ESG, environmental, social, governance, etc., etc. But unfortunately, you know, many, many companies in Malaysia are, shall we say, more than a few steps behind the global trends.
It's such a refreshing take on it to hear you say it, to hear both of you describe it as a hand up, right, instead of a hand out. And I guess, was that what you were trying to achieve? Because I read that, you know, you used you had this sort of pay what you can system for your clients, and then you also provided training for some of them in certain instances as well.
Yep. Okay. I would start from the beginning. Yeah. It's like this. Not that we don't value money. We like money a lot, right? But here's the thing. If someone who can afford a Starbucks coffee daily, right? That's what, 11, 12, 13 ringgit, right? And he gives us, say, 100 ringgit to buy or to sponsor 10 meals. That is, you know, a very small percentage of his or her income. Now, if you take that into the context of, say, a street client of ours, usually an old person who may or may not have a pension, generally alone, single either or possibly, you know, not in touch with or contact with their families, they used to survive. And I say used to survive by picking up recyclables. Aluminium cans, cardboard, not really plastics because plastic's not that valuable according to them. Yeah. Sometimes glass. And to give you an idea, right, at that point in time, recyclable aluminium cans, they used to sell them to a middleman who would sell them then to a recycler for anywhere between 250 to maybe 350 per kilo. Take a guess how many aluminium cans make up 1 kilo.
That would be a lot because they're very, very light.
Exactly. So we're looking at, it would be anywhere to like 45 to like 80. So you got to be scrambling in a lot of dump sites, dumpsters, rubbish bins, picking up a lot of cans to make that 2 ringgit 50 cents to 3 ringgit 50 cents. Now, if you've had a good day, you maybe have like, you know, 7, 8, 9 ringgit. Now, then you come to this cafe that gives you food for free, but you have earned money. That day you have worked and got maybe 7, 8 ringgit, but there is a box out there that says pay what you can. You take that money that you've earned and put in 1 ringgit, and you feel that you've paid for your food for the day. Now that 1 ringgit is not going to be, it's not going to stretch very far. It's not going to pay more our TNB bill, let's put it that way. But that 1 ringgit to that person who now says, I have paid for my food for the day because I paid what I can. How would that person feel?
It's empowering for that individual, isn't it?
And that's what we set out to do. You know, they're not taking, for that day, they're not taking charity, yeah? For that day, they are paying for their own food, not somebody else. You know, they have managed to support themselves. And it says a lot, you know. It does make you feel better when you are able to take care of yourself.
We take for granted, isn't it, that we can afford these little things in our daily lives?
We do. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of psychological studies on gratification. Someone who's earning like, you know, 5,000-6,000 ringgit gives 100 ringgit. And that gratification is not really that much. But you worked blood, sweat, tears, probably cut your fingers a little bit to pick up your 7-8 ringgit, and then you dropped in your 1 ringgit just to pay for your meal. We are only, in that sense, we are only intermediaries to a certain extent to you know, the process of them feeling good about themselves. We provide a channel, so to speak, a platform. But it is empowering for someone to be able to provide for themselves. And I think for us, seeing the expressions on their faces when they can put in that 1 ringgit, 50 cents, 2 ringgit, however much, you know, sometimes like, you know, they will splurge and like put in 5 ringgit. That's a lot for them. I think for us, that kept us going for quite a while. And then we also had people coming in and looking for jobs, right? And for many of them, some of them were in their 40s, 50s, maybe primary school education, basic secondary education, and they were no longer hireable in the conventional regular, you know, sense of the word. So we tried to look for jobs for them. Then we also realized the longer you are on the streets, the more hardcore you are, as some people would put it, the more survivalist you become. Yeah. And when we say survivalist, it's like this. You are reduced from, you know, every day thinking about how do I pay my bills, you know, how I'm meeting up with friends. You are reduced from all of the conventional societal standards to I need shelter, I need food. So I'm thinking about where my next meal is, not even what happens the next day. Yeah. Where's my next meal going to be? So your world has shrunk to the next meal and the next meal and the next meal. And where do I sleep for the night before I go for my next meal? And that is so simple, right? So simple. And we try and catch them before they go into that kind of primal mode. And that's when we started the training, the culinary training project. A lot of heartbreak, a lot of frustration, a lot of tears. It's challenging.
Because we hand-held each and every one of our trainee. They were family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think for many of us, there were some huge, huge learning curves there. That was when, you know, we not so much first. It's always intellectual until it becomes real. And that's when we saw the effects of, I would say, lack of nurturing, yeah, when they're growing up, for instance. We saw the effects of even lack of nutrition when they were growing up. Because some of these, we call them kids, but, you know, many of them are young people in their early mid-teens, right up to their early, even late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, some of them were in their 30s and 40s too.
Yeah, but
emotionally, developmentally, they were still children because they were so naive in so many ways.
They're good at surviving on the streets. But when it comes to the navigation of what we think of as normal life, they're completely and totally stumped, right? Like, how do you like even pay a postpaid phone bill? It's like, you know, they go into shock, right? Because everything is instant, everything is for the day. And that's when we realized also that what we were doing was brutally and frankly not enough. Because we caught them in mid-cycle. You have to get them as early as possible in the cycle. And this will include therapy, for instance. Yeah, this would include reintegration, some form of reintegration therapy, which FYI, we don't have. Yeah, some of them are hooked on drugs or trying not to get hooked again on drugs. But every day is a struggle for them because when your only way of escaping is through drugs, it's very tempting. And then, you know, life becomes hard because you've got to start thinking about my daily chores, you know, keeping myself clean, blah, 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 when previously all I had to do was worry about my next meal. It's scary. It gets very scary. And we were not equipped for it because there was just two of us, some volunteers. Yes. Challenging, very, very challenging. But when you're trying to pull someone up, sometimes I would give you the analogy of this, right? I might be the one that people see with my hand reaching out to pull someone from a pit or a hole. But behind me, right, there's, you know, Andrea hanging on to my pants and then another one hanging on to my belt.
You literally need a whole village to help you.
Because, you know, you don't want the person holding the hand out to like tumble and take a fall. So behind them is a whole bunch of people hanging on to them so that, you know, they don't slide down. You get the picture, right?
It, you know, as the saying goes and as Andrea said, you know, it takes a village.
It does. It does. And we were bringing up children. They might be in their 20s, 30s, but to give you an example of one of the kids that we took in, this girl, we believe that she has undiagnosed, she's probably definitely on the spectrum. So because of certain tells in her behavior. But this girl, she's been in the foster system when we got her, she was in her late 20s. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yeah. She was in the foster system since she was, I think, 10, 11, 12. She had a father who was a drug abuser. And her mother, she actually found her mother murdered when she was like 3 or 4 years old. And then she was shunted off to her grandparents and her uncles, and her father couldn't take care of her because he was in and out of rehab. And eventually she was put into a foster home, and she had, you know, she tried coming back to her family, stayed with her uncle, who made her look after her very ill father, who was at that point in time HIV positive and dying of AIDS. And then when her father died, at the grave, you know, the uncle basically kicked her out of the house and said, "It's your fault because your father died." It sounds like some major Chinese serial drama Minggu ini all rolled into one, but it's a mm-hmm. real life, right? And she ended up in foster homes, in the system, in and out, ran away, on the streets. And when we first met her, you know, it actually takes something out of you. I know it took something out of me when the first time when she was regular here eating, and then after that, I didn't see her for a few days. And then when she showed up, I scolded her. I said, you know, where have you been? You know, we were worried about you. How come? And she actually looked at me and burst into tears. And I was like, okay, I didn't scold you that hard. And she said, no, you are scolding me. I said, yes, I'm scolding you. And she said, yeah, but nobody's ever scolded me that way before. Nobody's ever scolded me because they cared that I never showed up. And I was quite taken aback by that, because I was like, I scold you lah. And this girl and a few of the others, whenever we raise our hands, like to point or whatever, the first thing we see is a flinch, right? They're so used to being hit to a raised hand, not for a hug, not for anything. They're so used to pain, right? It's like being with a constantly abused puppy and retraining them. It takes a huge, huge toll on your emotional state, I would say. Mm-hmm. I think Andrea and I took turns saying, I don't want to do this anymore. We had our moments, because so every time we came across these experiences, we were like, I don't think my system can take this anymore.
It's draining.
It's very mm-hmm. draining.
And yeah. then to find that child, when you hug her, she has a huge crater on her skull that indicated she probably been abused before. And we were the only family she found after a long, long time.
And this is just one story amongst, mm-hmm. you know, many. And I think for us, I think the first 3 years, especially the first 2 years, 3 years, especially, it was huge learning curve in terms of not necessarily just the financial aspect. In fact, while that was not the least of it, I think for us, the psychological aspect, the mental and emotional aspect of having to disassociate and distance ourselves in many ways. We had to learn that the hard way. Otherwise, I think the two of us would be like absolute messes. Absolute messes. And you have to learn to operate from a disassociated point of view, because you cannot you cannot let your emotions take control, otherwise nothing gets done. So yeah, that was what, you know, running the training program did to us. It basically, you know, kind of took us to hell and back, and that was just us.
And but that's also because you put yourself into it, right?
Yes, stupid enough to do so, yes.
We'll go for a quick break now. I'm speaking to the co-founders of the Pit Stop Community Cafe, Joycelyn Lee and Andrea Tan, and they've been sharing what it's been like at the Pit Stop since they began in 2016, and some really heartbreaking stories of the people they've met and helped over the years. So we'll continue our conversation after a few messages. Keep it here on Good Things on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Su Ann. On the show with me today are the co-founders of the Pit Stop Community Cafe, Joycelyn Lee and Andrea Tan, and they've been sharing what running the pit stop means to them and the people that they've met and helped along the journey. Now, what has it been like after pandemic, or AB, as you said earlier, Jocelyn? I've seen your posts on your social media page, and it's been a tough 15 months, I imagine, for you and also the people that you've been helping out. So what has it been like in the past year?
Okay, so just to give you, again, a little bit of context and background, Andrea and I are what you would call zombie apocalypse fans. We look at the absolute worst scenario. Yeah, and my previous background used to be in CRICOM, crisis communications and management as well. So we look at the absolute worst scenario, we look at the absolute best scenario, and we look at everything in between, right? So we have plan A, B, C, and plan X, Y, Z, in case plan A, B, C fall through kind of thing, right? And when this new virus started coming up, I think that was in November, December, when it first started hitting the news in China, we were like, okay, is this going to be a new SARS? Is this going to be a new H1N1? And we monitored things very closely, and people were still going, ha-ha, and it's going to be confined and all that sort of stuff. And that was when we started stocking up on...
Canned goods,
masks...
Sanitizers.
Hand sanitizers, bleach, because if it's going to be a virus, anything antibacterial is not going to be as effective. We started stocking up on all of that, right? And people kind of looked at us and went, okay, are these two crazies at it again? We would go into like a wholesale pharmacy and say, okay, how much face mask you got? Okay, we'll take like, you know, 3/4 of your stock. And even then, it wasn't that much, you know. It really wasn't that much.
It was just precaution.
And then things started getting seriouser and seriouser. And I will tell you this, ironically, March 15, 16, it started. Ironically, a few days before, you know, the MCO happened, you know, Andrea and I looked at each other and went, ah, crap. The only thing that we didn't stock up on was toilet paper. Everybody ran for toilet paper. That was the only thing we didn't get.
And people were hoarding it.
Yes. Yeah.
So most people was busy in the supermarket. We were busy hoarding in our little cafe.
I mean, we already had a mini stash. And when the MCO hit and when the calls started coming in, that was when we realized, much as we wanted to prepare ourselves, we were not even close.
I mean, can't imagine the scale of it.
We couldn't. We didn't imagine the scale of it. You know, suddenly people were calling, crying for masks, for gloves, for PPEs. That was the one thing that we missed out on. You know, we didn't have that many PPEs. But, you know, we thought we had enough gloves and masks to last at least a few months. We just didn't expect the, we need masks, we need gloves. And we were like, oh my God. And then we looked at our, like, what we thought was a huge mountain of stock. And we're like, we're going to go through this in a month.
Mm-hmm.
Months of stocking, right? Months and months of stocking. And we were like, the amount of demand that came in was...
Because everywhere ran out. And hand sanitizers, most of the pharmacies were restricting you to 2 to 3 bottles, maybe
five.
Yeah,
they had a purchase quota of like 3 tiny bottles per person. And we were looking at our, like, you know, 1 liter, 2 liter, 3 liter bottles going, whoa, we're rich! But it wasn't
little
enough.
Do we know.
But it wasn't enough. So we started stocking up. Or some people would call it hoarding. We call it, you know, zombie apocalypse preparations. We started stocking up months before, and we didn't have enough. We then started calling. And at that, even at that time, I would say this, Malaysians are amazingly generous. The moment we put out a call, I mean, things started coming in. And we were like, wow, the outpouring of support, not just for us, but for all the other groups that we worked with was amazing. Mm-hmm. And that was the first round of MCO. And things weren't that bad at that point in time, right? People were afraid, people were in fear, but at the same time as well, it was an opportunity for them to do something. It was still... a novelty, I would say. Yeah.
And for many of them, they still have the energy most importantly, they still have the savings. So it is possible to find that odd one box of gloves and something like that and get, you know, your Grab driver or whatever to bring it to us. But as the MCO progressed and you can see the economic downturn where everyone is feeling the pinch, suddenly everything is a lot harder.
So fast forward to 15 months later, you have donor fatigue, and that's coming in. You have an increasing born tired weariness of dealing with paperwork. And I will say this, you know, the flip-flopping on the need for documentation for those of us who are doing this work, I mean, that's not on, man.
Yeah, and the bureaucracy.
The bureaucracy that goes through it. We are incredibly fortunate that, you know, we have been working with DBKL, parties in DBKL, and they appreciate the work that we do. So when this round came about, you know, we got our DBKL letter, and so did our collaborators, our friends, you know, the Pratibi and Kachara people and a few of the others.
It was a huge relief.
But the other paperwork that is needed for your trucks to run, for instance, we rescue food, yeah? But I am so glad that we do not have trucks that need MOT, METI, JKM, and God knows what other paperwork. It's a headache. If you want to see how horribly challenging it is, you know, our Kumbara kitchen has been going through some absolute hell. We've also fortunately had Lala Move approach us as well.
Yes.
And what Lala Move did was, you know, we are going to give you
X amount of credit
for you
to do your good work. So use our fleet.
Yeah. So we use Lala Move to send food to
everywhere.
Well, not everywhere, quite a number of places, because we have to be very, very judicious with the credit that we are given as well, obviously, right? But they were lifesavers, yeah. Those of us who did not have wheels or those of us who were stuck, those of us who could not get papers, you either sit down there and wait for your papers while someone starves, or, like I said, someone like Lala Mu comes in and says, you know, use my fleet, and they save lives. So we were very fortunate. But now, coming back to 15 months on, to be very frank, Suan, we're tired. We are so tired, it's not funny. You're so tired. Some days you are so tired, you cannot sleep. And we're not the only ones. Every one of us who is doing this and has been doing this consistently, you know, it's come to the point where we have you either sit in a corner, you know, rocking back and forth and saying there's no place like home and waiting for someone to give you a jacket with extra long arms, or you develop a very sick and twisted, morbid, gallows humor kind of thing. Unfortunately for some people, we have, you know, developed the latter. So sometimes we find things funny when they're not.
But most of us who are in this industry, a lot of us are exhausted and we are brain dead. There's no forward planning because you do not know what is going to happen next week.
We are firefighting every single step of the way. We are all facing many forms of donor fatigue. Funds are not flowing in like they used to. Some people have gone back to work. Some of our contributors have gone back to work and found that they have had pay cuts. So, you know, that obviously impacts our income as well. Some of our contributors have lost their jobs, you know, and some of our contributors are just afraid because they don't know how long this is going to last. So they stash every single cent they can. So the first thing that goes is, and I quote, doing charity, right? Or you cash in your investments, if you want to put it that way. Or you cut what you think is an investment that is not giving you returns. And these are the first things to go. So donor fatigue is a very, very real thing.
Even when it comes to our volunteers, a lot of them are senior citizens. So a lot of them say, I can't come to volunteer now because I'm afraid of the virus.
And it is extremely valid, very, very valid, because everywhere you go, you're going to expose yourself. What more if you're high risk? And of course, Andrea and I, being very, very paranoid creatures, we have limited our circle to such an extent that all volunteers who come in, we don't accept new volunteers, except once in a while by referral. We limit our volunteers to what we call the task force. And our task force is tired, right? The task force was put into place in the first MCO, and this bunch of volunteers who come to us and help us out with the prep and the vegetable prep. Someone's got to peel potatoes and onions, okay?
And also distribution
and cleanups. They're also tired and they're exhausted because we've been going through the same volunteers over and over and over again. Why? Because again, you know, we don't know. When a new volunteer says, I want to come and volunteer, we don't know where that person's been. We don't know if that person is responsible. We don't know if that person has been exposed in any way. And we're not going to take the risk because Andrea and I sat down to draw a picture of what would happen, right, should something absolutely horrible happen and someone was even identified as a close contact. First, we shut everything down and we have to sanitize, and that is a huge operation in and of itself because we have a lot of food stored, right? That's number one. But number two, the number of people that we will have to get in touch with, right? You're talking about people who run soup kitchens, who run food banks, right? It's not just us who has to shut down. They will have to shut down. And then there are 20 over homes that will not be getting food for at least 2 weeks, if not more, right? And then there is food that will die because we cannot get to them. We sat down and we counted, and we just stopped counting at about, 3,000 plus people.
Wow.
We just stopped counting. I mean, you think of it, right? Assuming one average size home, and this is a welfare home, right, is anywhere from 30 to 40 kids, and we have about half a dozen of those. Another one has about 60 to 70 kids, and we have five or six of those. And then we have a shelter. And then we support a food bank, and that food bank reaches out to a couple of hundred PPR homes, households, right, once every 2 weeks. Now, imagine that food bank cannot run. And then we support also, with our food rescue activities, a soup kitchen that pushes out 500-600 meals a day, 6 days a week. And that's not including our 180-plus meals 4 days a week. And then you just do that, right? And the multiplier effect is horrifying.
Okay. That was that's quite a lot to think about. I mean, the repercussions of one small slip of safety issues, right? It's so wide for you guys.
Yeah. So we were and are still extremely paranoid to the point where, you know, we have very, very strict even delivery and pickup SOPs as contactless as possible. And we deal literally in rescuing tons of food, yeah. So all this documentation, sometimes it doesn't make our work easier, lah, huh?
Yeah. How has the MCO also affected the people that you've been helping, you've been working with as well? You mentioned at the start, you know, that starvation is a huge issue. And I think that's been that main worry for a lot of people, right? The getting that next meal on the table as well.
There is a report called Families on the Edge by UNICEF and I believe FAO as well. Yeah, it's a joint report. I can tell you this, that report, you read it, you're going to go, oh, wow. That report is only the tip of the iceberg. That report does not reflect the true horror of things. I kid you not. Yeah, I kid you not. We're not even talking about the psychological effects of people, you know, cooped up, of entire families cooped up in 500, 600 square feet, impossibly positive, right? We're not even talking about the horrible psychological effects of children not being able to go out, right? Children not being able to go to school, children being able to get fresh air, okay? All of that. We're talking about all these people inside that, no money because they are daily wages or they're selling goreng pisang by the roadside and their savings have run out and they're living on, you know, whatever is left. The worst thing is this, poverty is expensive. Poverty is extremely expensive. And I will give you a simple illustration. One pack of instant noodles you go and buy in 7-Eleven is what? 2 ringgit something? 1 ringgit something? One ringgit something, yeah? But if you go and buy a six-pack of instant noodles in hypermarts, right? It's anywhere from like 3 ringgit to 4 something, right? So it's huge savings if you can buy something in bulk. But if you cannot afford that, imagine like, you know, two, three people surviving on one packet of Maggie a day, right? And it has happened and it is still happening. And I would say this as well, okay? You can't live on instant noodles. And especially a family cannot live on a packet of instant noodles. But you see, that is the most accessible food compared to, say, other things that might cost more. So you will spend your 1 ringgit something or your 2 ringgit something for your couple of packets of instant noodles because you can't afford anything else. Poverty is expensive in more ways than one because if you're a small family, poverty is expensive because you are forced to spend more for less. Poverty is expensive to the system because, you know, these people are going to grow up and they're not going to have the right nutrition and they're going to fall sick and that impacts the system. Poverty is expensive to society because taxpayers are going to be impacted because, you know, your social issues are going to rise, which means more money has to be spent to address those issues. It's expensive on the health system. It's expensive everywhere. But I don't know why people don't see it. Poverty is expensive. We need to come up with solutions. Now, at this point in time, that's besides the point. Mm-hmm. We just got to stop starvation. And I know some people think we're exaggerating. We're not. Not really. We're not.
We've been getting more and more calls asking for help for food. Basic essential items.
Imagine this, right? We thought we had gone through the worst, and late last year, we put out a call and said that we had, you know, one more slot in our list of welfare homes, and it's all filled, right? And then, you know, a contact of ours pinged me and said, okay, you know, I need your help. There's this home. The founder passed away, so it's now run by his widow. Can you help her? And for us, it was a matter of, okay, we have to vet and make sure that they're genuine. They're not just asking for cash, whether the kids are treated properly. So she comes in and we asked her, okay, what's your story? At that point in time, they had a one-ton lorry that they used to go and collect recyclables so that they can sell so that it helps to pay the rental for the home and everything else. But that obviously had to stop. So they were, I think, three, four months.
At that point in time,
they hadn't paid rent for 3 or 4 months. They had survived on ad hoc donors and contributors. Obviously, all that had stopped. So they owed the local sundry shop money until the sundry shop didn't want to give them food anymore. They were backed up on their TNB bill for several months. And, you know, then I asked this lady, okay, how many kids do you have? At that point in time, 55, right? 55 children. And I asked her, okay, how much food do you have left? She was ashamed. She couldn't look at us. And for us, reading body language is very important because it tells whether someone may or may not be lying, someone is in need, or someone is, you know, what their emotions are. And it helps us basically make a judgment call whether to help or not to help. She was looking down. We didn't know why. And then we asked, how much rice do you have? Now imagine this, you have 55 kids, 55 growing kids who have not been going to school, so they are full of energy and they're running up and down. And you have 2 bags of 10 kilo rice left. You have 1 carton of baked beans. You have 1 tray of eggs. You have an empty freezer. And you have bread that people have contributed. And that's what you've got to survive on. 1 carton of baked beans is 24 cans. And then I asked her, do you need sardines? No, sister, it's okay. I still got one carton of sardines. One carton of sardines, 24 cans. Now, how long is that going to stretch you? Assuming they don't have three meals a day, assuming they just have two meals a day, yeah? WHO standards requires that an adult meal has 75 grams of dry rice per meal per day, right? Even if you cut it down by half, her two bags of rice will last her maybe 2 days, 3 days. And then what? So that was instantaneously we decided to help. And then this brings me to the next issue that we both have, that we constantly have, all right? How do you make that judgment call on who to help and who not to help? Who is more in need, who is less in need? And we face that every day. And in some ways, it's not very fair on us and on the people that we have to make the judgment call on. Because, yes, there are a lot of scammers out there. And that's why we have to vet. And vetting takes time. So all that slows us down and then people go hungry. But these are some of the challenges that, you know, we are faced with. But we also have scarce resources at this point in time. Between donor fatigue, between, lower rescued food amounts.
Not to mention sometimes, even if you have the money, sometimes you can't buy the product because manufacturing levels are down now.
Yeah.
FMCO, because, you know, 60% of the staff is working, the other 40 can't work
in
the factory. So everyone is having a crunch time, even the manufacturers.
So, I mean, okay, just to give you an idea, Cameron Highlands, for instance, because it's under EMCO now, we're going to face, and we are already facing a major drop in Cameron Island
sourced produce.
Mm-hmm. That means prices of the remaining vegetables coming out of there is going to rise. You know, and the knock-on effects of all this is just going to be increasing and increased food insecurity. Yeah. People, if you want to cut it all the way down, people don't know where their next meal is going to come from. Many people will not know where their next meal is going to come from. And that is, you know, food insecurity on a small scale. But on a larger scale, we are not prepared for large-scale food insecurity. We're not. It's just mind-blowing, the issues that we face every day, day in, day out. If anyone can talk to the farmers at... we've just heard bits and pieces. They're struggling with manpower issues, right? They're struggling with production issues. Their vegetables might be on the vine, yeah, but, you know, they don't have the manpower to pick it, and therefore they cannot sell it, and therefore, you know, they run at a loss.
Or they don't even have the logistic to come down because of the bureaucracy.
Yeah. Long and short of it, you know, in the lowlands, we are deprived of these vegetables, and therefore the current vegetables that we have, you know, goes up. We've seen the price fluctuations of food, and this contributes to hoarding. This, again, contributes to food insecurity. This contributes to a whole host of issues.
And surprisingly enough, they contribute to food waste because it's too expensive for a lot of people.
Yeah, it contributes to food waste as well because people cannot sell. So then, you know, if we can, we rescue. If we cannot, okay lah, mati lah, masuk landfill lah. So conversely, it contributes to food waste. Even though production has dropped or may have dropped, it does contribute to food waste because logistics, you know, gets screwed up. One little spanner is all it needs to kind of screw up everything, really.
I guess to wrap up, if there are people who are listening who can or who can afford to help or who want to help, you know, what can they do or how can they reach out to you?
Well, get in touch with us via our Facebook page, Pit Stop, under Pit Stop Community Cafe. If you look for us, send us a message. Honestly, I will say this, we may not answer immediately. We may answer a few hours, even 24 hours later. I do apologize for that. In advance, please be patient. That's number one. Two is our email is info@pitstopcafekl.com. We do respond to our emails. Again, you know, within 24 hours, we will get back to you because we actually do have a lot of work and we're tired. And, you know, help would be so much appreciated, either financially or in kind. But message us, talk to us. If you have food that needs rescuing, come talk to us. Yeah. If you're a food producer, you have near expiry goods, through 2, 3, 4, 5 months to expiry, not past expiry, but to expiry, come talk to us. You know, there will always be a place that we can redistribute your food to, that we can rescue, because there are people who will need that food.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much, Andrea and Jocelyn.
Thank you for having us, Wen.
I've been speaking to Jocelyn Lee and Andrea Tan, the co-founders of Pit Stop Community Cafe, on this episode of Good Things, where we speak to good people doing good things. If you missed any part of today's show or you want to catch previous episodes of Good Things, you can look them up on bfm.my or on the BFM app. I'm Lim Soo Ann, and this has been Good Things on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.